Welcome, this is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and it is the 17th day of October 2011, and we are joined on the line once again by our regular weekly guest, Bob Chapman, a.k.a. the International Forecaster at IntForecaster.com. Bob Chapman, always a pleasure to have you on the program, so thank you for your time, and today I'd like to actually start with something a little bit different. Today we had a listener write in and contact me through the contact form on CorbettReport.com to ask me to ask you a question, so let's get straight in with that, and I'll just start by quoting it and getting your thoughts on it. He writes, quote, "Ask Bob if this idea is feasible. Monetize gold and silver at $10,000 and $5,000 an ounce to begin with. From there, you take that 1 ounce and you break it up into grams, 10,000 divided by 32 grams of gold. Then use the amount of grams as your money to purchase items. The cashiers issue a plastic card for the money that's not spent, similar to a gift card, or it can be recorded on a debit card. This system is not easily corrupted because it's based on the person having gold or silver to begin with." And I'll end the quote there. So I guess a lot of people obviously interested in the monetary system and how an actual gold and silver, a direct gold and silver monetary system could work, or would it be feasible at all? So Bob Chapman, your thoughts on that?
I never thought of that, and I think it would work. I think that still a very, very small percentage of people know about gold and silver in America. And to some extent, that's true throughout the world. And we see large buyers in China, in India, in other nations. But overall, throughout the world, people who own physical gold and silver still make up less than 1% of the population. So that's why in changing monetary policy, governments, if forced to, would hold in reserve gold or silver, and usually it's gold. And they have been bimetallic backings through the centuries, but they've tended not to work well. Because they don't work good in tandem together. We tried it during the Continental period from 1790 to 1800, along with a lot of other things, which included British mercantilism, which today is called free trade and globalization. But usually a backing, and I would have to say at this point in time, the backing would have to be non-reversible because of what we experienced in August the 15th, 1971, when the backing was taken off of the dollar, which was in the form of gold. Supposedly, the gold still exists. I don't think anybody believes that, but they did that because of the tremendous inflationary spending which was emanating from the Federal Reserve, which watered down the value of the dollar and prompted other nations, which could at the time accept gold in return for dollars. And that went on for a couple of years, particularly via Charles de Gaulle, who was then the president of France. And so the easy way to do it is to put a solid backing of, say, 20 or 25% in gold or in silver. But gold, as I said, has been the preference over the years. And so that would solve the problem. And they could use U.S. notes or paper money of some kind. You can also go back to using certificates that were redeemable in gold as well. So there's a lot of ways you can approach it. The fundamental underlying problem is that we're looking at government after government, year after year, who do the same thing over and over again, which is print money so they can get reelected, and basically. And that continuum is not going to stop. And so you have to have controls on government. Getting them is another thing. And we see today throughout the world, not only in America, that governments, particularly the representative part of government, which we'll call the House and the Senate, are controlled by money. And you have people behind the scenes who have very large amounts of money, who have usurped the function of democracy by buying more than 50%, actually. The figure is far larger than that. And they've stopped it to some extent in Europe, but certainly not in the United States. And it's very frustrating because most people don't really understand how that works. And they continue to vote for whomever they want to, and the parties not understanding that the people running in both parties are financed by the same group of people and from which you're going to get the same results. And so how do you get that changed? You get it changed by having a middle-of-the-road to conservative president and a Congress in the same policy or mode as the president said. And that's what America needs badly. And so changes in the Federal Reserve and the ultimate monetary policy that could be part of the Treasury would have to include a devaluation of the currency. And I think that is not difficult to come by, because if you have a large meeting, which they've had before, these nations, and devalue and revalue against one another, and multilaterally default on debt, then I think you'd see people demand a gold or silver backing. And once that were attained, then you wouldn't have to go to exchanging buying power or currency for actual gold. And so there are easier ways to do it, but in the long term, if you wanted to do that, it would be workable. And one of the problems you're faced with here is people don't understand anything about money. All they're interested in is doing the job, getting what they get paid to do, and spending it, and maybe even spending more than they made because of the use of credit. And so it's a hard sell because people don't understand. And I've even talked to people with degrees and advanced degrees who don't get it. So, and I think bankers and governments are counting on that. And that keeps the public from demanding sound money. It's just plain ignorance.
Well, unfortunately, there is a lot of ignorance on this subject, and you do highlight one of, I think, the very important problems here, which is that the political theater that's dangled out before us, before our eyes, is really nothing more than theater. It's more of an illusion of what's going on, and all of the action is really happening behind the scenes. And I think real monetary reform is really the basis on which any real political reform can happen, because as you point out, unfortunately, the politicians have long since been bought and paid for by the financial interests powers behind the throne. But if I can play devil's advocate here for a moment, and I think I can, I would add the caveat that it's not just a question of politicians printing money in order to win elections. I think there's something more to it than that. It's that politicians are usurp or abdicating their government's own ability to create money for itself, and is instead borrowing that money from private banks in order to buy off the public every 4 years in the election cycle, which I think is even more insidious, because again, the power actually lies with the governments themselves to simply print money interest-free, debt-free. There's no such thing as sovereign debt. That's actually a contradiction in terms. So I think that the system becomes more ridiculous the more you look at it. And secondly, I think it's slightly insane to base a monetary system, a means of exchange, on items that are dug up out of the ground and the vagaries of that. I think gold and silver are self-evidently great stores of value, but as a means of exchange, I don't know how workable such a system could be.
Well, I've used it in the past, but we've been dealing with populations that are far smaller And culturally, you know, you can go back 6,000 years that we know of, it was perfectly acceptable. And as you point out, is it workable? Well, I think it is on a long-term basis. It all depends on the approach, and it all depends on the circumstances. And the easy way to do it, as I pointed out, is to have government back their currencies. And it's simple. But the move was in the other direction because, that is over the past 30 years, is because of the control factor. And they wanted a international move toward fiat currencies, and they got it. I mean, the only currency that has any backing whatsoever in gold is the euro, and that's about 6 or 7%. And why is that? Because they went along with the other central banks and that program to get rid of gold backing. And so they, at their inception, only 10 or 11 years ago, they had 15% backing. And it shows you the large amount of gold they sold into the market in order to suppress gold prices and at the same time bring about, we'll call it the theatization of the euro. And the last currency besides the euro to get rid of gold as a backing was the Swiss franc. They still hold the gold, assumably, but it's not backing their currency anymore. So the easy way out is to back your currency. And then the price of gold will increase in value until they do that. And even after that, even if they set gold prices, say at $10,000 an ounce, and say silver at $1,000 or $2,000 an ounce, you still would have free market. And would the free market accept what any given currency was doing? You know, over the last 12 years, the 9 major currencies of the world have fallen over, this is on average, fallen over 20% versus those 9 currencies every single year for a dozen years. And that's because they don't have any gold backing, and that's because they keep on creating credit and printing money. And who's doing that? The central banks. Yes. The pointing out of fiscal irresponsibility, especially now that government, the U.S. government is spending $1.5 trillion more than it brings in revenue. But still, the main creator of inflation is the central bank, in our case, the Federal Reserve. And they're going to keep right on doing that. You know, we have a G20 meeting that just got over. And the bottom line is, well, we have to have more money for the European Financial Stability Act or group, whatever it's called, EFSF. And, you know, the big question is, where's the money going to come from? Well, none of the banks can do it because central bank says they don't have any money and they can't create like the Fed can. So it falls upon the U.S. And if you noticed over the past several weeks that the Fed has made a swap of dollars with other central banks, and the only real driving force is the U.S. Fed. They're the ones who are creating and dispersing the money. The other 4 central banks had nothing to do with it. I can promise you that. And they had to inject dollars into the banking systems of Europe. And the reason why was, and still is, money market funds and others who go into short-term paper, they have about, out of a total of $625 billion, that's an approximate figure, they were in for about $400 billion in that short-term paper in Europe, and they withdrew a good part of that money. They're down to about 30% right now, from about 60. So that would be a large deduction. And in order to offset that, the Feds created the swap. Well, who's on the hook? The American taxpayer is. Because the entities to which the gold went to, central bank gold, the dollars went to, central banks, they have to pay it back. Maybe they won't. And I think there's a good chance that they won't. And, you know, it wasn't too long ago that the GAO discovered under the Dodd-Frank bill that the Fed had created money and credit of $16.1 trillion they never told Congress or anybody else about. And so what they are is a force unto themselves. And they do it secretly. That's not the way our government or those who service our government are supposed to act. And so with that said, that's why Ron Paul wants to get rid of the Fed as a figurehead. And he's right. And I've been talking about it for 53 years, but because of the internet and talk radio, we're able to get to people today and explain to them what the Fed has been doing, which has essentially been looting the United States citizen. And they'll continue to do it. And you can't stop them under present circumstances. And the reason you can't is the people in Congress, probably 90% of them, are bought and paid for. And so that's the box that you're in. And you know, how do you get out? Well, you change the people in Congress. And if you can't do that, the Fed's going to go off the deep end trying to save themselves and the banks. And they're going to bring everybody down. And that's what they're in the process of doing right now.
There's a lot of points there, but that raises in my mind the question of the European bailouts and how they're really working with the European Financial Stability Fund or whatever it is. I assume those bailouts are really being denominated in euros, but that raises the question, is the central bank just printing those euros, or are they in devaluing the currency, or are they actually raising their holdings of gold in order to continue to back up the supply?
Well, very few European governments are gold buyers, so that's out. And they're not creating euros. The digital transfer, let's say, of money market fund A to the Central Bank of France to buy short-term bills of 3 months, the transference is dollars, because dollars are being used in trade. Dollars are owed as well. And what has to happen is that the funds have to be digitally available. And they are if the Fed creates them. If the Fed does not create them, that's a totally different story, because that takes the whole system down. The European monetary system, especially the Eurozone, is in deep trouble, and they're not out of it, and they're not going to get out of it by switching money back here and there and everywhere. You get six members of 27 in the European Union, of which 17 belong to the Eurozone. The others have their own currency still, like in Sweden, the Corona, and in Denmark, the Corona, and in Norway, the Corona. And Kroner is very popular, which means crowns. But the point here is that there cannot be any stability. And I don't think we have to go into the reasons why it happened. But what are they going to do now? The G20 talks about creating more money. Well, there are certain rules constitutionally and within the rules of the European Central Bank that they can't do that. And in Germany, which is the leader of the pack, so to speak, the court in Karlsruhe, which is the equivalent of our Supreme Court, I'll put it that way, they said, you can authorize the usage of funds, but they can't be leveraged, and they can't go beyond that. So Germany's hands are tied unless they change the Constitution and have a referendum to do so. Well, all the politicians, anybody who does research knows that's not going to work, because varying from state to state within Germany, between 55 and 75% of the people do not want them to do that. So the Constitution wouldn't probably be changed, and a referendum would be damning and would remove the current political leadership in the country. There's no way out for them. And the best thing for them to do is what I proposed 2 years ago. Allow Greece to go under and completely absolve itself of debt and leave the euro, use a drachma on a 50% value basis so they can compete easily, although they don't export much at all. It's really a tourist destination more than anything else. And that would solve Greece's problems, and of course the bondholders would be in terrible shape. And not only the sovereign nations, but the banks. And the banks in New York that have insured via derivatives part of the debt that banks in Europe are holding in behalf of Greece. So there's a chain reaction there. This concept of connectivity has turned into a monster. The connectivity was created between banks and central banks internationally on the way to creating a one-world bank in a one-world currency. Well, it didn't work out that way. And now that connectivity is killing them, because five or six major banks in Europe, if they were to go under, it'll take the whole system down because they're so interconnected. So that's another big negative they have that they never expected. So if Greece goes under, others like Ireland will say, gee, our politicians sold us out. We should have never taken responsibility for about $70 billion worth of debt that the banks had created. And why they accepted that, I'll never know, and how the people went along with it, I'll never know. But anyway, that party had been in power, I don't know, 70 years. They're out of power right now. Because at least that was the reflection of what they had done. But if Greece were to do what I just suggested, then Ireland and Portugal should definitely do the same thing. And people, the public, are in no mood in any country to put up what has been going on with what has been going on and continues to go on, the looting of their economies by the banks. And you're seeing demonstrations all over the world. This past weekend, Rome was afire, and you had more demonstrations in New York and London. This is not going to stop. You've got massive unemployment. Provides a lot of people to get out on the street. They don't have anything better to do and say, I want a job. I want the banks to stop looting us. And so this is not going to slow down. It's going to grow and it's going to get worse, which adds to the problems of people who run countries and central banks. Sort of like gumming up the gears so that they don't work. And at the same time, you look at the ludicrous situation, which is created by intervention by central banks in each economy, where you have stock markets in different countries going up, and these horrible things are going on. And you say to yourself, well, how can the markets go up when the economies are slowing down and people are demonstrating throughout the world that they don't like this and they want you to do something about it? And so as we go along here, we're having more and more turmoil, and I don't think it's going to stop.
Well, a fascinating and frightening overview of things there, and I would venture to posit that the reason that the Irish people, who have been so historically independent and independent-minded, were suckered into the bailing out of their governments, their governments bailing out of their banks to the tune of $70 billion, is pretty much along the same lines of how they were suckered into the Lisbon Treaty, which, of course, as my long-term listeners will remember, was basically the EU constitution in all but name that Ireland took the heroic stance of actually stopping in its tracks. So basically the EU bureaucrats, tyrants came along and said, you're going to vote until you get it right. And they voted again, and unfortunately passed it. So again, that's sort of the background to the subjugation, the resubjugation of the Irish people. But you did write quite a bit about the Irish situation in the Forecaster. Perhaps you could share a little bit more about the context of their particular issues and how they came to this point.
Well, it's the same in Spain as it is in the United States. The banks decided, and they're foreign banks owned by the royal families of England and Holland and the Rothschilds, they decided they were going to lend without limit. And they've got thousands of houses that have been built in Ireland where there's nobody to go and live in them. It's not a very big place, population-wise. And so the tremendous debts that were created couldn't be paid, and the banks were on the hook, and they decided that they would solicit the Irish government to take the debts off their hands, and they did. And, of course, one cannot sit back and say, well, that was the only thing to do, and, of course, it wasn't. The thing to do is say, no, we're not going to assume those debts, but they did. So look, somebody get paid off. You know, the backhander was there. And can you prove that? No, you can't, unless somebody owns up to him and said, yeah, over there at the Bank of England, they gave me £10 million to get this thing through. And it probably happened that way. But anyway, that's how they acquired the debt of the banks. And if I was Ireland, first of all, I would default, like in Greece, although they have a much stronger economy, and go back to the punt, which is the name of their currency, and tell the EU and the Eurozone to take a hike. And I think that's the best thing for them to do. Ireland has a positive balance of trade with the United States. They have many corporations from America in Ireland employing people, but vice versa. And so they have a positive flow, which is unusual, and it's good. But they're never going to solve their problem unless they default. It would take probably anywhere between 30 and 100 years to pay off that debt. And their economy wouldn't be able to function well over those years. It would be like a demi-zone where it was never light and it was never dark. It was gray all the time from a financial viewpoint. And that's the way they live, just like Greece. If they don't default, they're going to live that way for decades, and it's not necessary. The bank should have never made the loans in the first place. They are the professionals. The politicians and the public are not. And I know you all believe that. And so the responsibility lies in the banks. that means all the banks go under. And not only do they lose their money, but they lose the public's money that's in the banks, although perhaps insurance that these banks have via the government would work to some extent. And let's say the public ended up with 20 cents on the dollar, so to speak. But it would break the back of the banks who are causing century after century the same problems over and over again. And they would lose their power. And that means their power to control politicians with money would be over. Think about that. And so to break the back of the banks is really the solution, as painful as it's going to be. That's what we have to do.
Well, I think you've just raised the most important point, really, of the entire conversation, of all of these conversations, is that the banks use money as a way to gain power and leverage over the politicians, and thus over the people. And to me, I mean, that raises an important point. And would you agree or disagree with the statement that fundamentally this isn't about money, this is about power?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's prevalent in every country. And these people all talk with each other. And you have these scions of industry and business that have billions of dollars, when in fact they really don't control it. All they're doing is investing the money of the people who are behind the curtain, behind the scenes, who are really controlling things. And this is why the way banking has got away with this for centuries. You know, people didn't catch on and didn't have communication. We've got it today. Broadcasts like this are being absorbed all over the world. In Ankara, Turkey, and Tokyo, and Shanghai, Singapore. I mean, I know because I get letters from all these places, and we have subscribers there. And they're so happy that we're doing this, because they understand and they want everybody in their country to, because everybody is getting screwed in every country, because these people cooperate with one another from behind the scenes, whether it's from London to Paris or from Paris and London to Mexico City. They're all hooked in together. They were all involved in the suppression of gold and silver collectively in a conspiracy to remove it as a backing, them as a backing on currency. They didn't want it. Why? The more money that they can create, the more money they can lend, the more money they can earn, and the more power they have. They're megalomaniacs. These people are absolutely insane. They're not happy being the richest, most powerful people in the world. They have to enslave everybody. And when you get to that point, the clock breaks, and there is no more time. And you see what you're seeing right now in cities throughout the world, people protesting, demonstrating. There has been some violence, but not much, considering the possibilities. I mean, supposing you had been out of a job for 2 years, 3 years, or you just came out of university in the United States and you have a bill of $100,000 to pay, and you can't get a job to pay it. And you can't go bankrupt because they won't accept that in bankruptcy. I mean, what kind of a situation is that? It's unbelievable. And so it's going to explode. And it's moving in that direction. And the slower the better, of course. And what a government's going to do? They're going to create martial law. Where's that going to lead? To revolution. So the people at the helm who have all the power, they had better back off. They had better pull things together and try to tough this thing out to save the economies of the world. Because if they don't, they will never, in their lifetimes at least, exercise power as they have in the past. This is a two-edged sword, let me tell you. They picked it up, and they've swung one way. And if they try to come back with it, there's going to be something meeting them there with resistance. And you're seeing it now in the streets.
Well, certainly for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. And as you and I have noted many times in our previous conversations, we are approaching and entering a very, very exciting and very dangerous time, I think, both at the same time of the people really starting to learn what's going on and starting to reassert their powers and try to take some of that power back from the politicians who have usurped it from them in the name of the banksters over the centuries. But of course, in that process, as people are only dimly aware of all of the system and how it works and what's at base, they might strike out in ways that are counterproductive, and some indications of that are coming from some of the recent rioting we've seen. For example, this past weekend, as you mentioned earlier, in Rome, some riots broke out. And reading from a Seattle Times story that is a reprint of a New York Times story, Italy in angry, unsettled mood after Rome riot, and it says, as the smoke cleared Sunday, a day after a peaceful, inchoate demonstration near the Colosseum turned into a riot, Italy fell into soul-searching and finger-pointing. What caused the violence was clear. Groups of violent youths smashed shop windows, torched cars, and scuffled with police, turning a coordinated march against global economic woes into the worst riots in Italy since the Group of Eight summit meeting in Genoa in 2001. But what was less clear was why the Italian authorities had failed to prevent the violence, or how it would reverberate in the most volatile political climate in Italy in decades. And to my mind, that story raises the question very much of the possibility of provocateurs and paid agents provocateurs used by the police to turn peaceful demonstrations into riots, because as you and I know, the authorities are designed and set up and willing and able to deal with rioting groups of people who are just smashing shop windows and doing other nonsensical acts that won't manage to do anything to affect political change. But they don't know how to deal with large masses of people who just take the power into their own hands and refuse to go along with it and participate in coordinated strikes and the like. So what do you think? Are we entering are you an optimist or a pessimist? Do you think ultimately this will turn into something positive, or will this just be turned and steered away by the provocateurs, and will the people lose their last chance at really taking the power back?
Well, in exposing the truth, you are met with the situation as it really is. And I'm a very optimistic person. Otherwise, I couldn't handle the kind of work that I do. People would say to me, well, gee, how can you deal with all these negative things all the time and not have a problem? Well, I don't. I'm just built that way. My blood pressure is 100 over 65, and I'm 76 years old, so you figure it out. But the point is this, that we got to try to work through the system as long as humanly possible. And we can do that by removing the people in office in every one of these countries. I mean, Italy and Berlusconi was only one vote away from getting thrown out of office. They're going to have another vote this week in Italy. And he probably will be deposed. And he's part of this international banking combine, if you want to call it that. And it's surprising the violence that has been engendered in demonstrations turning into riots and then violence and destroying property. We saw it throughout England not long ago. We've not seen much of it in Greece, but in Italy we're starting to see it. We didn't see much of it in Madrid and in Barcelona, but it was militant. We haven't seen any of that in the United States yet. They're way behind the curve of the other nations. There can be a lot of reasons why they haven't been violent. And I'm glad they haven't been. But as I said earlier, if the powers that be are not going to do something about this and try to bring normality back, then it's going to get out of hand. And they may not be capable of doing that. You know, we've just seen over 3 years, QE 1 and 2 and stimulus 1 and 2, and we're moving into QE 3 right now. We may even get stimulus 3. It's not the answer. They know that. They really don't know what to do beyond that. And what is the classical answer from classical economics, Austrian economics, if you may. And that is to purge the system. Well, gee, if they purge the system, all the bankers will be out of jobs, they'll lose everything they've got, and they'll no longer be powerful. And that's why they've been avoiding taking this over the edge into deflation, depression. Whereas now, they're happy to be able to have a continuum extension into the future by using inflationary tactics. But at the same time, purchasing power falls and savings and pensions get disemboweled. And they're just playing against time, and it's not going to work. And it's going to blow up in everybody's face. And it's not going to be a nice end, especially in the United States. Because if they try to use 500,000 law enforcement people against 150 million armed people, what do you think is going to happen? It's not going to be nice. And the military can't even handle it, and they know it, because I've discussed it at length with military people from all services and all ranks, from generals and admirals down. And I think that the people in power behind the scenes, Wall Street, the City of London, etc., I think they think that they're going to tell the military what to do, and I don't think it's going to happen. I think every country is going to end up with a coup, and hopefully they can put back a government together that'll work before everybody's killing each other just to eat. And we don't want that. But we're being forced toward that end. And these people in government and behind government think they can handle it. Well, I got news for them. Forget it. Not a chance. Not in the United States. I had a conversation last night with some people from Scotland and about crime and the things that go on and the riots in England, which they were very familiar with. They said, look, the people can't even defend themselves. They don't have guns. Only the bad people got guns and the police. And it shows you how important being able to defend your country and your constitution is by having the right to bear arms. Because all these other nations, unless they want to use their bare hands against groups that are controlled by the power structure behind the scenes, such as law enforcement and the military, they don't have a chance against them. So the big chance, really, is in the United States, and it's going to come. Just look back at 1789. The people with rakes and hoes and scythes and anything they could get their hands on, clubs, on August the 14th invaded the Bastille. And that was the beginning of the great change in France. But many people get killed in the process. And after that, many people were beheaded. 300,000 people lost their heads.
Exactly. Yes. Well, we shouldn't forget.
That is what is going to happen in every nation if these people don't get their act together.
Well,
desperate people do desperate things.
That's unfortunately true. And I think it's important to understand not just how the French Revolution occurred or what the beginning of it, but to also see how it played out, because it's quite depressing to see the way that the revolution was turned into basically just another form of tyranny. And eventually, of course, General Bonaparte took over and started his own tyranny. So I think we have to be careful about the way this is done. And I certainly don't want to hope for a military coup in every country, because that's definitely not what I'm hoping for. I really do hope that people can hopefully take this upon themselves to organize in something more along the lines of a 1776 than a 1789, because I think the former was at least more hopeful in a lot of ways than the latter. But obviously how this will play out is still a very much an open-ended question, so we'll have to leave it there for today. But turning our attention to the work that you've been doing, of course, tireless work on so many programs all around the world, as you say, and getting this word out to so many people through the Forecaster, perhaps we could talk a little bit about the work you're doing at internationalforecaster.com.
Well, it's a lot of work, I'll tell you that. And we're usually working 17 to 19 hours a day. And we're happy to do that. Gathering, harvesting, I call it, information from all over the world. And we have a lot of sources, and we have a lot of subscribers. I just got a piece in over the weekend from Greece and what's going to happen there. And these letters and these commentaries by intelligence operatives that we put in the publication are spot on. I mean, they're news that you're not going to see anyplace else. And they're from, you know, average people who happen to be in the right place at the right time. So we're covering things that nobody else does. And there are a handful of publications who do the same thing or try to. And I'm happy about that. At my age, I want somebody else to take over. But anyway, I obviously enjoy working. Well, the International Forecaster is about business, finance, economic, social, and political issues all over the world. Published on Wednesday and Saturdays by email. Runs around 35 or 40 pages each time. We have a hard copy, which goes out twice a month for those who are not on the internet. And everything you need to know each week is in that publication. You can get a free introductory copy by going to theinternationalforecaster.com. The International, FORECASTER.com. Or you can go to www.INTFORECASTER.com, intforecaster.com. You can also go to our email address. If you'd like to ask a question, we answer everyone. Get a free copy of either, or get a copy of our latest report on gold and silver shares. That address is Bob, B-O-B, at intforecaster.com. That's B-O-B at INTFORECASTER.com. For those of you who'd like to call toll-free, that number is 877-479-8178. 877-479-8178. And they offer a free copy of either of the modes of production of the publication. And they also have a special deal there for those who want to become subscribers. And so if you want to get a free one-year subscription, call and look at the deal that they have. It's terrific. It doesn't get any better.
Indeed. Well, on the note of a man of your age, I understand a happy birthday is in order.
Yes, thank you very much. It was yesterday. I had a few little parties over the weekend, dinner things, and it was wonderful. I get out to play golf, and I'm all stuffed up for all of those flowers and things on the golf course. But anyway, I get some exercise, and as far as I know, there's nothing wrong with me, and I'm very happy about that.
Well, we're happy about that, too, and it's good to hear that you're out and still living an active and healthy and productive lifestyle. And I think you're an example that we can all look up to in that regard. But on that note, why don't we end it there? Another fascinating conversation, so thank you so much, and I'm looking forward again to next week.
You bet. And I'll be there, and I love doing it.